This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, September 28th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Yesterday, Christine Blasey Ford, the psychology professor who has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were in high school, spoke before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
When she was asked to name the strongest memory she had of the alleged incident, she recalled the display of male camaraderie between Kavanaugh and his friend, Mark Judge.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
Kavanaugh testified in the afternoon, opening with a very long statement in which he furiously described Blasey Ford's allegations as a partisan attack, motivated by revenge on behalf of the Clintons, as he put it, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
This is a circus. The consequences will extend long past my nomination. The consequences will be with us for decades. This grotesque and coordinated character assassination will dissuade competent and good people of all political persuasions from serving our country.
Jeannie Suk Gerson, a law professor at Harvard and a former prosecutor, joins me to discuss what went wrong with the confirmation process and what Kavanaugh's testimony might indicate about his performance as a Supreme Court justice. Welcome, Jeannie.
Thank you.
All right, let's back up a little bit. The hearing yesterday wasn't a trial. It was actually exactly the kind of grotesque political spectacle that everyone predicted it would be, with supporters of Blasey Ford and supporters of Kavanaugh using the testimony to justify their predispositions about the two. And it also confirmed what the public has long believed, that our elective representatives are not doing their job. So members of the Judiciary Committee, Republican and Democrat, complained that the process was unfair, even disgraceful, but they designed the process. This is their job.
Well, I think that both sides were pointing fingers at the other side about the problems with the process, that neither side was taking responsibility for the problems themselves. So each side really feels like the other side was in control of the key elements that have made this entire process so unfair in their view. So how might they have done it? I think that when the accusations by Dr. Ford came to the awareness of Senator Dianne Feinstein, I do think that she was in a hard spot because she had to keep it confidential. She understood that. But I also think that there are some greater duties that you have as a senator on the Judiciary Committee to make sure that an allegation like this, if credible, be explored in the proper ways. And I do not believe that there was no way for this to be explored without revealing Dr. Ford's identity. So I do think during that time that she held the letter confidential, as she said, there could have been more done on the part of Democrats, certainly, to get the ball rolling in terms of the allegations and to let the members of the committee in on what was happening. And I think that that might have ended up with a better process. I do not think that the Republicans have a good point that it is now too late for a federal investigation by the FBI. That was not a convincing argument that they made over and over again.
And then what about subpoenaing Mark Judge, his friend who was allegedly at the party, and other people that Blasey Ford recalled being there? There are many ways that we could come to a clearer sense of what happened.
I think that's where you're getting into a very difficult tightrope between a court process, where you would have all kinds of witnesses who are relevant, and a confirmation hearing where it seems more justifiable to a lot of people to have the two main parties, the accuser and the accused. However, in this particular case, because the accusation centrally involved the presence of Mark Judge, that omission to subpoena him was really inexcusable.
Even many people who believe Blasey Ford is telling the truth wonder how the senator should be deciding in the absence of corroborating evidence.
Well, I think that that is an interesting question because of the history of rape law. It was, in fact, the case that in the old days, you had to have corroborating evidence in order to convict someone of rape in a way that you didn't have to have for any other crimes in general. It was the rule that just the alleged victim's testimony would not be enough to convict a person of rape. And that was an exceptional rule, which meant that for other crimes, it was perfectly fine to convict someone based on testimony that was admissible and credible enough that the jury, the fact finder, could decide. People are convicted all the time based on testimony that is credible. That is evidence. So at the end of the day, you have to take all the evidence that's available and decide. And it is not a precise science, but it is the system that we have, both in the courts and in a proceeding like the one that we have witnessed.
I'm curious, as a former prosecutor, first, what did you think about whether she met the standard that you're discussing?
I think that the credibility of Dr. Ford was very high. And based on her testimony, I think that a lot of people, myself included, could conclude that she was telling the truth. That credibility assessment is not just about, are you predisposed to believe victims or not? That's not what credibility is about. Credibility is about an individualized assessment of somebody's testimony based on the content of that testimony, the consistency, and things like demeanor, which is why the live hearing was so important for both the senators and the American public. That demeanor is a really key piece in courts as well as in a proceeding like this.
And what about his demeanor?
Well, I was quite surprised by Judge Kavanaugh's demeanor, I have to admit, because everything that I had come to expect from Judge Kavanaugh was that he was somebody who had really cultivated a very even-tempered manner and a presentation, a very judicial presentation. I think that it was very interesting to see that the presentation that he chose to give yesterday, both in his remarks and in his response to questioning, was not that at all. It was very unjudicial. At times, it seemed like he was regressing to boyhood, almost like he was 17 years old answering these questions.
And protesting too much.
Yes, protesting to every question and really refusing to engage respectfully in a way that truly seemed out of character based on what we had seen so far of his demeanor and all that is known about him. So it was very surprising. And I think that there are two possible reads on this. One is that this period has been extremely trying for him and his family, and it was very emotional, and he really lost control. That was one possibility. The other possibility that it was a more strategic and calculated decision to present in that way, because given where we were, given where he thought the president was and where the Senate was and the credibility of Christine Blasey Ford's testimony, he thought his best shot was, in fact, to change persona and to present a much more raw, emotional, and angry face, and somehow that would be more beneficial to him, given the parties who really need to stick behind him.
And Trump had pretty much demanded he do exactly that and was thrilled by his performance.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Yes, to the extent that Trump was the audience that he was aiming for, I think he really succeeded.
It was kind of astonishing, I thought, as the afternoon wore on and the focus in the room shifted from the totally incompatible testimony of the two witnesses to the war between the two political parties. And we saw Democrats rebuking Republicans for refusing the FBI investigation, Republicans scorning Democrats for creating what they saw as a final attempt to smear Kavanaugh. And then Lindsey Graham, I wonder if you just talk for a moment about the role he played, where he began shouting himself, and then it all became each Republican trying to one-up the next on his support for Kavanaugh.
I think Kavanaugh really set the stage for Senator Lindsey Graham to do what he did. But even if Kavanaugh had not done that, it is very possible that Lindsey Graham would have taken the bull by the horns at that point. I think that it was a desperate strategy, but also a very brilliant strategy in that I was watching Fox News to see what they were saying, and I heard commentators on Fox News all but admitting that this nomination was going to be finished. That is what was happening after Dr. Ford testified. And so at that point, what do you do when lots and lots of people are saying that they find her credible? I think that you've got to change the story. And the story can't just be she's not credible. It's got to be a different story. And he very effectively did that by changing the story to the unfairness of the process, and also by changing the tenor of the hearing from one that was calmly, politely, and sensitively trying to probe whether something happened, to one that was about grievance and about anger, using very extreme terms like shameful and disgraceful. It just really is, both emotionally and intellectually, was a very, very drastic change. And Senator Graham was the linchpin.
Our Capitol Hill correspondent, Osita Nwanevu, pointed out the Democrats' failure to ask Kavanaugh the very questions they were demanding the FBI ask. They had their moment, and they didn't do it. So, you know, the allegations by the other two women, Deborah Ramirez and Julie Swetnick, that just all went out the window.
Well, again, I think there are two possible reads on that. One is that it was somewhat disingenuous that they really wanted answers to these questions. And that was revealed by their failure to ask those questions when they had the opportunity. But the other read is that, in fact, it was a protest of the fact that there was no FBI investigation. So they did not want to give in to the Republican narrative that, well, you have this opportunity right now to ask him those very questions that the FBI would have asked. And the Democrats didn't want to give in to that by saying, okay, we now have the opportunity to do exactly what the FBI should have done. Either way, it really was in some ways unfortunate that those questions did not get asked, because it is very possible that they would have been effective in trying to get Judge Kavanaugh to really engage. But based on what we saw, it is also very possible that he would have evaded those questions and done the same thing he did the rest of the hearing.
Several senators on the committee were also on the committee during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings in 1991, including the chairman, Chuck Grassley, and then Orrin Hatch and Pat Leahy, a Democrat, all of whom voted to confirm Thomas. There was an interesting moment yesterday when Leahy addressed Grassley directly and said, you know, you and I were both here 27 years ago. At that time, the Senate failed Anita Hill. I said I believed her, but I'm concerned that we're doing a lot less for these three women today. That's my personal view.
I think a lot has changed since 1991, and this particular moment was a moment of recognition that not everybody who was there in 1991 would feel the same way if the Anita Hill testimony were being given today. I think that it is true that there was less being done in terms of the investigation of the claims that are leveled against Judge Kavanaugh than we had for the claims against Justice Thomas. And mainly that has to do with the lack of an outside investigation by an impartial party, such as the FBI. On the other hand, there have been a lot more allegations here in this scenario, and there is kind of this circus-like environment where it feels like it's very hard to actually get some purchase on an orderly way of doing it without letting the entire thing spin out of control. So I have some sympathy for the idea of trying to limit the sphere of what the committee was trying to consider.
You know, Leahy also said, bravery is contagious. Indeed, that's the driving force behind the Me Too movement. But as we saw throughout the afternoon, bluster, swagger, dishonesty, cowardice, obstruction, all of that was on display. And so I guess the question is now, we're taping this at 11:30 in the morning. So what can be done now in legal terms? Is it too late to lodge a protest?
Yeah, this whole thing is quite a disaster for anyone who would like to take seriously the legitimacy, the dignity, and even the majesty of our courts, and particularly the Supreme Court. I am a law professor. I teach students every day. I'm going to teach constitutional law at 1 o'clock today while this is going on. And it really calls into question the enterprise that we are engaged in when we look at the role of the Supreme Court in American society. And when we see that this is the way in which members of that court are selected, what I would like to see is an honest reckoning with all of the issues that we've had to deal with during this confirmation fight, and to try to not let them go the same way next time. If there is an accusation, which surely in the future there will be, that there should be a process decided in advance that we know that we can count on. That's a really important part of what makes our society stable. And that is precisely what is at stake and in danger today. For a lot of people, it may be just about sexual assault. It may be just about Roe versus Wade and abortion. But really, the overarching issue is about the stability of the rule of law. And we can't have that without legitimacy of our institutions, the Supreme Court and the Senate being two important ones.
Thank you so much, Jeannie.
Thank you.
Jeannie Suk Gerson is a law professor at Harvard, a regular contributor to NewYorker.com, and the author of a memoir, A Light Inside, An Odyssey of Art, Life, and Law. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This program is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
Experience today's headlines live on stage at the New Yorker Festival. October 5th through October 7th, Sally Yates, Adam Schiff, Michael Avenatti, Jill Lepore, Carmen Perez, and more will be in conversation with New Yorker editors and writers on the provocative topics that matter the most. See the festival lineup and buy tickets at NewYorker.com/festival. That's NewYorker.com/festival.